You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm George Cedarquist, joined by Oliver Camacho and Weston Williams. All right, this week, hometown team Chicago Opera Theater announced its new season. Lawrence Edelson joins us to unpack the first full season he programmed as the company's recently appointed general director. Plus, in the two-minute drill, we have the latest royal news. No, not Kate and William or Meghan and Harry. It's the Royal Ballet and Opera. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Spotify. You click follow on Apple Podcasts. You hit the plus sign. Send us a voice memo or email us your hot takes, mailbag at operaboxscore.com. Even just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com. However you contribute, and we want you to contribute, you're going to get the OBS beer coaster, OBS lapel pin, and the number one OBS fan foam finger just for sharing your own hot take. Let's get right down to it, Oliver Camacho.
It is getting to the tail end of the clay court season, and it's getting messy. Everybody's getting injured. We just saw the end of the Madrid Open, one of the one Masters 1000 series, and Carlos Alcaraz did not make it to the final. Very disappointing. Mm-hmm. But what was so weird, and to illustrate the injuries that are happening, one of the finalists, a Canadian who I actually like a lot, Félix Auger-Aliassime, who was touted as being like the next Roger Federer, but hasn't really lived up to that. He has not made it to the finals of this type of event in a while, but he had the weirdest path to the final. Dropped the first set in his opening match to Nishioka, and then won 6-1, 6-4. In his round of 64, okay, he handily beat the Italian Mannarino. Then things started getting weird. In round of 32... his opponent, Menjik, retired in the second set after dropping the first set 6-1. In the round of 16, he beat Casper Ruud, who could have won. He was the fifth seed. Then Yannick Sinner, the probable winner of that half,
jeez, okay,
did not play the quarterfinal match, citing injuries. And then his semifinal, after six games, his opponent, Lehechka, also retired. So he had three walkovers out of seven matches. And he was doing very well in the final against Andrei Rublev. He won the first set, but lost 7-5, 7-5. Poor guy. Really dejected when he gave his finalist speech. Right. And Andrei Rublev is definitely very deserving. But we have another Masters that's starting, the Rome 1,000 points, and that is the one that happens right before the French Open. So let's see if whoever's playing can stay healthy and compete at Roland Garros.
That was so marvelously detailed, Oliver. I love that tennis is such an international sport that virtually all the people you just mentioned could be the librettist for a new opera.
I think we should at this point just spin off Oliver's tennis talk into a separate show called Tennis Box Score.
You haven't seen Challengers yet, huh?
I have not. I have not. We can do a full review on the spin-off podcast.
So many thighs. So many thighs.
I still need to watch the Kentucky Derby. Let's talk some opera.
How about we root for the home team?
Welcome to Opera Box Score. Do you prefer to be called Larry or Lawrence?
Larry.
Okay, but you are Lawrence Edelson. You are the general director of Chicago Opera Theater. But before we talk about COT, I'd love to just give the audience an idea of who you are and what your start was. I understand that you began as a stage director. I understand you work with Rhoda Levine, who actually used to teach at Northwestern University. So I wonder if we have similar Rhoda stories.
I adore Rhoda. In fact, I didn't get started as a stage director, though. I got started as a singer. My background originally, I was growing up in Ottawa in Canada, and I was doing my Bachelor of Music in voice and musicology. I was a tenor. At that time, a tenor with no high notes. And
can relate.
I did 3 years of my degree. At the same time, though, I was studying dance. And I got an opportunity at the end of my third year of my undergraduate to do a summer program at the Joffrey Ballet when they were still in New York City at the Joffrey mm-hmm. Ballet School. And I decided I wanted to do that. Was, you know, I was taking dance to help me move better on stage. I was a little overweight as a singer, and it was something I thought at that time would complement what I was doing with my singing. Mm-hmm. But my entree into opera was definitely as a singer. And I went for a summer, and my parents said, he's never coming back. And they were right. I moved to New York and I stayed. And I ended up dancing professionally for 7 years. I ended up becoming an apprentice with Boston Ballet and then dancing with Ballet West and Ballet Met. And that brought me into choreography. And I was always really fascinated by creative process. And it was through choreography that I actually got into directing, because I started choreographing opera. And a real fascinating Chicago connection, one of the first operas I choreographed was a production of Carmen directed by Amy Hutchinson, who is here in Chicago. And it was one of her first directing engagements. It was for Opera Columbus. And this is going back quite a while ago, but she asked me to help stage the Act Three fight, you know, between Escamillo and Don José. Mm-hmm. And both she and the singer said, you know, you kind of have a knack for this. You might want to consider directing. And so I went back to school. When I stopped dancing, I actually moved back to New York City, and I was singing, and I started doing young artist programs, but I went back to school for directing. And that's how I got connected with Rhoda, because I was hired as an assistant director at Glimmerglass, and I got to assist her on her production of Little Women, which is when I met Mark Adamo, who has become a very close friend and someone who was instrumental in my founding of American Lyric Theater. And that was also my entree to directing at New York City Opera. So it's a sort of tangled web of my path to directing, but it really intersects with my love of singing and my background in dance as well.
Okay, I'm going to just say that we're similar in age. I don't know exactly how old you are, but I think we are pretty close. And this path seems like, you know, whatever, three different careers. And now we're, I don't know if we're in the end game now, if you're going to decide that you should be in politics or something.
God, no.
But I do want to say that I find that sometimes I disagree with what happens on the opera stage, because I feel like the director, A, doesn't like opera, or didn't listen to the music, or doesn't respect the conventions and what the composer's goal was in adding dance music into a show, why it's there, even if it's not something the composer even wanted, but why it has to be there, and why sometimes it's necessary to respect that and give the audience dance, because those composers actually knew what they were doing. So there's so many things, like when I go see, you know, updates or maybe stripped down productions, maybe out of necessity, I feel like, ugh, like this is not the experience of this opera. This is not going to bring people to opera. You think you're being so clever. You think that you're whatever, doing some minimalist version of something, but you're fighting the music. You're fighting the composer. You're not serving it, you know? So to hear that you have this experience sort of makes me feel better about you being...
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that you worked with Rhoda and that you know her. You know, she always talked about her role as a director as being an advocate for the audience. And I really hold that close. And I also think part of my role is being an advocate for the composer and the librettist. You know, I am an interpreter as a director, but if I don't believe in a piece and I don't believe it, you know, in the material that I have in front of me, then I shouldn't be directing it. And it's not to say that I'm against updates. I have updated some productions when I felt there was something about the story and that the music that that led to that, but it was still really respecting the material. But I'm not into updating for updating's sake, and I don't think one needs to update an opera to make it relevant. I think that's where we fall into problems, where people make an assumption that just because a work was written in the early 19th century, that it doesn't have relevance to a contemporary audience. And that's just ridiculous. Yeah. You know,
that the audience is too dumb to
exactly, exactly. You know, so I consider the score and the libretto my guide to whatever I'm doing artistically. And that, you know, that's why we're doing the piece, is because, you know, there's something about that combination of text and music and the story that we're going to bring to life that is exciting.
Well, part of your brand does seem to be developing composers, developing librettists and dramaturgs, and to that end, developing new works. And that, I guess, is like the mission of the American Lyric Theater. Can you talk about founding that?
Sure. So American Lyric Theater is based in New York City. It's a company I founded in 2005, so almost 20 years, which is kind of ridiculous when I think about it. The idea for ALT came out of conversations I had with Mark Adamo when I was at Glimmerglass, actually. We were talking about the abundance of young artist programs for singers and how that had really changed the landscape of American opera in terms of providing mentorship and opportunities, and how nothing like that really exists for those writing operas. And while I love the canonic rep, I love obscure rep, as you will discover, I also was really interested in contemporary work and was wondering why more contemporary work wasn't better, to be honest. You know, it was just like, why am I seeing so much new work that doesn't have the sort of integrity, that sort of cohesion of music and text? And why aren't these pieces having more future life after their first production? And there's a lot of reasons on the, you know, the administrative side and the producing side for that. But the bottom line was that there really, at that time, was no robust opportunity for the training of opera writers the way there has been for singers. There is still to this day no school in the United States, no graduate program where you can get a degree in composition that's focused on opera writing, you know? So I said to Mark, I said, this is something really interesting I might want to create. And I think he thought I was joking around, but he said, sure, well, call me if you ever do that. And a couple of years later, I was finishing my master's in arts administration, which I did at NYU. And I decided to put this company together. And my first calls were Mark Adamo, the dramaturg Corey Ellison, and composer Danielle Catan, and composer Anthony Davis. And that was the founding faculty for ALT, with the mission to provide the same sort of robust training and mentorship for opera writers that exists for opera performers.
It's hilarious when you think that, you know, over the 400 years plus of Western classical music history, beginning with the Baroque era, that the main objective for so many composers was to write opera. And we have conservatories and universities that know that teaching singing is a cash cow for them. And yet, just because you said it just made me think of it, but yet how many of these schools actually are developing opera or new operas and providing that opportunity for their composing students? You know, it's a no-brainer. But I wonder if that has to do with the way opera is thought of in our society, the way, you know, it's sort of a joke, or it's like seen as like a dying art form, or it seemed to be elite, or all of these things that I think often music schools, and especially, you know, the attitude of some conductors and some leaders, it stigmatizes singers that they were not musicians, that we're not, you know, we're not smart. Of course, I can't drink together a sentence. So
not smart for doing new opera, you mean?
No, just that, like, that singers aren't respected, and like opera isn't respected. And I think that there's like this attitude that, like, oh, you came to conservatory to study singing so you could be on stage and so you could wear costumes, and like, it's not, and like, generally when people talk at musicians, they distinguish between singers and musicians, you know, like this type of attitude. I mean, there is this I'm embarrassed to say, but there's a major orchestra in the Midwest. I won't say which one, but there's a Facebook ad right now for a Mahler symphony. I guess it's two. And the conductor is fully named, and then the vocal soloists are called, and two female soloists.
Well, there's a bigger discussion there about how classical music is marketed, and that's we could have a whole separate conversation about that sometime. So, but also, and the role that artists play in contemporary American society. Again, another conversation, right? So,
Before we jump into your role at COT, can you also, it sounds like you already started ALT with the idea of inclusion with Catan and Davis as part of your founding group, but there's something very deliberate that you're doing at ALT, the Opera Writers Diversity and Representation Initiative. You guess you call it Audrey or...
You can say Audari if you want to try to string those things together, as an acronym. But yes, the Opera Writers Diversity and Representation Initiative is the full, overly long name for this formalization of something that's really been core values for the organization since its start. We did some research starting in 2019, early 2019. The core program at ALT is the Composer Librettist Development Program. And so for those who don't know, it's a multi-year full-time program to mentor composers and librettists and now dramaturgs as well. And we looked at all the participants who have been in the program, and we looked at gender, we looked at age, and we looked at race. And while we were doing better than other initiatives and other companies in terms of producing contemporary work, in terms of diversity and representation, we certainly weren't doing what we aspired to do, And so we made some really conscious decisions. One of the most important was to go to a distributed leadership model. And that involved a national search for an associate artistic director. And we had Kelly Kuo, a wonderful conductor, join us in that role early 2020. In late, I'm getting my timelines. The pandemic messes up my brain when it comes to calendar, but that happened in the middle of 2020. But the other things we did was we took a very different approach to recruitment in terms of how we were reaching out to potential participants for the program, being very proactive to reach out to different schools and theater companies in the case of librettists, other programs that have mentored composers in a non-operatic sense, to have a more diverse cohort of applications. And it doubled the number of BIPOC applicants to the program. And we've continued along with this currently in the program. I think that 70%+ of the artists are artists of color. And we're developing a wide variety of work. ALT does not produce, as I know you know, Oliver, we partner with other companies. And of course, the partnership with COT for the Left and Death of Alan Turing is an example of that kind of partnership. But it's been really exciting to see that, taking a more proactive approach to something that is so important and has been part of ALT's identity from the beginning has strengthened these core values even further in action through all aspects of our programming.
Well, I just want to say this, and this is going to be a curveball at you, but I think based on what I already know about you and your brand, that you'll be okay hearing this. Opera, and I'll say even performing arts, in general, seems to be the leadership in these organizations seems to be a gay white men, like across the board. I know that COT had a couple of seasons where it was all women. Mm-hmm. But there was still, to me, a diversity problem with that, in that it was all white women leading COT. So I know that COT thinks about these things, and we can see in the work they're producing and who they're trying to bring to the pipeline. But this is something that I really care about, and I want to see these leadership roles also have a pipeline. So anyway,
let me come into that because that's not a curveball. I mean, yes, I am a gay white man. First, we're on the radio, so for those who don't know that, that is a fact. I am also someone with, you know, now 20 years of experience leading opera companies. Also, you know, was general and artistic director at Opera Saratoga, so I come with a fair amount of experience. But I do agree one of the big issues is leadership and decision making. Is very different at different companies based on structures. And I think, I mean, this is why at ALT we really changed the structure to a distributed leadership model. I've been here now 9 months and we are having discussions about what longer term the leadership model will look like, as you know, because Lydia Yankovskaya has stepped down as music director. But I think, you know, it is a big question of pipeline. We have an issue, and I think Opera America is trying to make some efforts, which are of mixed success, in terms of providing resources and training for people, you know, who have been historically underrepresented in leadership positions. And there's been much more success at putting women, providing the training and the resources and the pathway for women to be in leadership positions than there has so far in terms of leaders of color in the field. So I it's not really a curveball. It's a fact, you know, and I have to agree with you. And I, you know, COT has been working with an organization called the Diversity Movement, specifically to address what do we do? What is our role institutionally, our role within Chicago and our role nationally with those challenges? Because I think it is very important as part of COT's identity. I think it's something we all think about at COT, but we also know that those changes don't happen overnight, and they only happen if they're intentional.
Exactly. Anyway, I appreciate your, you know, being open to hear that and recognizing and affirming that it is an issue, because I think that when I say stuff like this, it's gotten me in trouble before. That people are shocked. Like, I represent diversity. I'm gay, or I represent diversity because I'm a woman. It's like, okay, gotcha.
No, I know that I don't represent diversity in my particular field. Exactly. That is, so I'm not going to pretend. But I care very deeply about my field, and I care very deeply about equity and diversity in the field. So.
Well, it seems natural now that all of these threads come together for you and that you seem now like a very obvious choice to lead COT. I don't think we need to spend much more time kind of unpacking your bona fides. So let's go ahead and talk about what this is your first season. Did you choose this season, the 24-25 season?
24-25, yes. I programmed this season and I cast this season. Yes.
Wonderful. So let's hear about it.
Sure. Well, I thought it was really important to, you know, stay true to who COT is. I haven't come to town to change that. I really was attracted to the fact that COT complements Lyric and complements other opera here in town. We also, besides Lyric, of course, we have Haymarket, you know, we have some of the summer festivals that happen. And I have always loved really eclectic repertoire, as well as new work. And so in looking at the programming for this year, I was thinking about what sort of pieces might we do that haven't been done in Chicago before that audiences may not be familiar with, but would be interesting to our audiences, as well as contemporary work. And I was also really thinking about what our role is relative to Lyric in particular. And Ferdinando Peer is a composer who probably most people listening have never heard of, even though he wrote over 55 operas. And his work, Leonora, is one of four pieces that were based on the same libretto and the same true story that happened during the French Revolution, which inspired Beethoven's Fidelio. And I had been thinking about Leonora as a piece for COT. It was written in 1804. It is a piece that has a classical size orchestra, has seven principal singers and no chorus. So it's a piece that's of a scale that COT can produce really effectively. We were also thinking realistically about the financial, side of producing a season. We are still dealing with some challenges, as are almost every opera company in the country. But then when I heard in some conversations with Lyric Leadership back in the fall that they had scheduled Fidelio, I was like, we have to do Leonora. I mean, this is not brain surgery. This opportunity to hear these two pieces side by side would be so amazing, especially because Beethoven had a copy of the score to Leonora in his possession. Beethoven really admired Pear. And it just felt like, you know, the perfect confluence. And around the same time, I had been talking with Jane Glover because I, of course, like everybody, admire her so greatly and wanted to see how we could keep her involved with COT. And she had not heard of this opera. And I was like, oh, my God, I found an opera that Jane Glover doesn't know. This is amazing.
You found an opera that she didn't write a book about.
Well, exactly. Right. You know, and so. She was very excited by it. It worked out with her scheduling in the fall. I was like, okay, this is done. This is how we're opening our season. And it's, you know, it is for lovers of great singing, like you and me, this is going to be a feast because there are two coloratura soprano roles, both with extraordinarily virtuosic writing, and there are three principal tenor roles. Unlike the Beethoven, Florestano is a tenor, but more of a bel canto tenor. And more sort of in the whole writing of the piece kind of lies in that saddle period between, you know, late Mozart and early bel canto. But Don Pizzardo is a tenor, unlike in the Beethoven, where he's a baritone. Mm-hmm. And the minister, you know, Don Fernando is also a tenor. So as a recovering tenor myself, I'm like, ooh, an opera with three tenors. I love it, you know? And then we have the baritone Rocco and the bass baritone Giacchino, who is a tenor in the Beethoven. So It's a really interesting thing to see how Per cast, you know, what his vocal casting was and how that impacts the dramaturgy, the musical dramaturgy of the piece. The other thing that's really, you know, fascinating about the piece is that it is an opera semiseria. So there are more comic elements in this piece. While it has the same storyline, the same sort of through line of narrative, the relationship between Marcellina and Giacchino is more prevalent in this opera, even though ultimately we get into the heartbreak and the political intrigue and the real story of a woman who how far she goes to rescue the man she loves. So I was just so excited that we could do this, and it will be the North American premiere of this opera, and in fact it will be the first staged production anywhere in the world using the new critical edition that Baron Ryder put together during the pandemic. So I'm just, as you can probably tell from my excitement in my voice, I'm really, really psyched to do the piece. And I will be directing this production. It will be my directing debut here in Chicago, which some people were surprised about because I tend to lean more towards contemporary work in my directing choices. But I just was so excited about the possibilities with this piece. Selfishly, I wanted to work with Jane Glover. So why not?
Okay. That's the fall show. And the next like big show is not until the spring, right? Or is it
right,
the summer?
So we have two large-scale, fully staged productions that bookend the season. So the Leonora is in the beginning of October. We have three performances at the Studebaker Theater. And as I mentioned, they're scheduled to complement the timing of Fidelio, so you can see them back-to-back. Mm-hmm. The spring show is early June, and that is a new piece. It's a world premiere called She Who Dared. It is a partnership with ALT, much as The Life and Deaths of Alan Turing was. And this is a piece that's written by Jasmine Ariel Barnes, who some people may know as a member of the Blacknificent Seven, who recently had a wonderful concert at the CSO. And Deborah Deep Mouton, she is the former Poet Laureate of Houston. These two are two of the most exciting writers in opera today. I'm just so excited to share their work with Chicago audiences. It is remarkably the first opera to be produced professionally that's been written by two Black female artists, and I think that's notable. It is a highly melodic piece. It is very influenced by Black musical idioms of the 1950s, including gospel and soul and protest music. And it is a piece that recenters the women who helped desegregate the Montgomery bus system in the 1950s that led up to the court case of Browder v. Gale. Of course, everyone's heard of Rosa Parks, but the fact is she wasn't the first to move. And this piece really demonstrates how everyday people have this power to change and challenge the systems around them, if only they dare. So we're really excited to be able to present this world premiere, have, again, a wonderful cast of singers, and it will be directed by Timothy Douglas, making his debut with the company, a wonderful theater director, and Michael Ellis Ingram, who is an American conductor who is primarily working in Europe now, but we're bringing him over to conduct the premiere.
Wonderful. And to keep the audience engaged in the winter or in the late fall, you have a Puccini show. It's a Bohème and Beyond, the Legacy of Puccini, a concert, which will have music by Puccini, but also by contemporaneous composers.
Contemporaneous and composers who came after from both the opera and the music theater sphere. I thought about doing a Puccini opera. Now, you know, COT's brand is not to do Bohème or Madame Butterfly. And I thought about one of the lesser frequently performed works, but ultimately we landed on this concert because I love Puccini. I love his writing is beautiful. He writes, and he has had a remarkable influence on opera and music theater in many different ways, in some ways that people might not expect, which is what I think is particularly interesting. So, you know, some people may not realize that, you know, for example, Katya Kabanova is influenced by Madame Butterfly. Franz Lahar's work was influenced by him. Of course, more contemporary composers like Daniel Catan, of course, you can hear, you know, the influences of Puccini in his writing, but also Richard Rodgers, Stephen Sondheim, Andrew Lloyd Webber, were influenced. Of course, the obvious ones are, you know, Jonathan Larson with Rent and La Bohème. So this concert is going to have scenes from Puccini's operas juxtaposed to other music by other composers from Puccini's time to present that were influenced by him. And that's our way of celebrating the centennial of his death, which has happened, which is being celebrated later this fall.
Wonderful. And lastly, I believe the Vanguard program, the Vanguard Opera Initiative, is that what it's called, the Vanguard?
Yes, the Vanguard Initiative, which is this wonderful program Lydia started to have a residency for emerging opera composers, and we are absolutely continuing that program. And even though Lydia has stepped down as music director, she is staying on board to continue shepherding that program. Carlos Carrillo is working with librettist Stephanie Fleischman on a piece. I am going to say the title in English, lest I offend any Spanish speakers listening. It is Various Remedies for the Afflictions of the Body and the Spirit. We're saying it, the short version of the title in Spanish is Remedios Varios, and it is a play on words on the painter Remedios Varo. Many Chicagoans will recall that there was an exhibition of her work at the Art Institute, a Spanish surrealist painter. And this new opera is inspired by the art of Remedios Varo, and very excited to see how this piece is developing. We've had a libretto reading so far. A piano vocal workshop is coming up. And then, of course, the Vanguard concerts that we have in the spring are the culmination of the Vanguard composer's residency with a full orchestral concert of the new opera.
So it's clear to see that with that opera being in Spanish, that you are trying to reach the very large Spanish-speaking population of Chicago. Obviously, She Who Dared is going to be an exciting show for its own sake, but has a very black perspective. The Leonora is for the classical curious, the Baroque and classical curious. And the Puccini show, the concert, really has a wide reach for maybe even first-time goers to this type of music making. So there's something for everyone. I think it's a bold season. That said, I think to have two operas that have names that people won't recognize is definitely a strong choice. But I'm with you. I'm very excited about this. Quickly before I let you go, can you comment on Lydia? And I knew that we couldn't keep her. I mean, once I realized who she was, when I first met her, when she was announced, like, oh my God, she's brilliant. And then I got to see her work, and then I got to see her dedication on top of how good she is as a leader, just how committed she is to all of her, personal mission statements. You know, she really does it. I knew that she wasn't long for any organization. She can choose wherever she wants to go.
Well, Lydia, I've known her for 10 years now, I think. I first met her because a conductor colleague in New York recommended her to me when I was preparing the first full workshop of The Life and Deaths of Alan Turing at ALT. Mm-hmm. And he said, you should get to know this young conductor. She's something special. And boy, was he ever right. You know, I hired her for that workshop. And not only is she just a phenomenal musician, but she's just the most amazing person, a wonderful collaborator. And we've worked together at ALT, of course. I hired her twice to conduct when I was at Opera Saratoga. Once was a piece by Grittery, and once was a world premiere by Ricky and Gordon. And so, I am not surprised her star is quickly ascending. And I will say I'm disappointed. One of the things I was excited about by coming here was working with her. And people asked, did I know when I was coming in that she'd be stepping down? And I said, I knew she would eventually leave. I didn't think it would be quite this quick. But we're talking about projects that we'd like to do here together in Chicago. She's staying living in Chicago. She has a family here. And she's continuing, to cast her net wide as she should be. I'm thrilled for her. I mean, if I will not be surprised to see her name on the billboard on the billboards of even larger houses very, very soon. Yeah. And we will do everything possible here at COT to make sure she continues to have a presence in Chicago in the future as well.
Yeah, we all have to hitch our wagons to her.
No, she's wonderful. She's such a passionate and a great colleague as well.
Well, Larry Edelson, thank you so much for sharing your personal story and telling us about the upcoming COT season.
Thank you for having me, Oliver.
You heard in the middle of that interview a little bit of the pair Leonora from a recent live recording at the Innsbruck Festival conducted by Alessandro De Marchi. And that was an aria for the title character, Leonora, sung by Eleonora Bellocci.
That's casting.
This just in, the 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Opera Land this week.
The royal headline, Mark Antony Turnage's Festin will receive its world premiere. Lisa Davidson sings Sieglinde and Bernstein's Trouble in Tahiti. And A Quiet Place finally gets staged at Covent Garden. More of the royal announcement after the drill.
In more royal news, the Royal Opera House is being renamed. Sort of. The company will officially be known as the Royal Ballet and Opera going forward in an effort to appease all of you ballet fans out there. The building itself will retain its singer-centric name.
The 2024 Kathleen Ferrier Award winners have been announced. First place went to Scottish tenor Matthew McKinney, who walked away with £12,500. British soprano Charlotte Jane Kennedy won the Ferrier Loveday Song Prize of £5,000. Held annually at Wigmore Hall, the Ferrier Awards describe themselves as Britain's most prestigious singing awards. Let's see what Britain's Got Talent has to say about that.
Speaking of singing competitions, Wales is set to get its own version of The Voice. the popular international vocal talent show. Four vocal coaches have been tapped for the program, including bass baritone Bryn Terfel. The TV show is set to premiere next year, so if you're one of our hundreds of thousands of Welsh listeners, let us know how he does.
Anthony Hopkins has been cast in an upcoming biopic about George Friedrich Handel entitled The King of Covent Garden. The film will focus on the composition of Messiah and will be directed by Andrew Levitas. I wonder how many Handel operas old Tony had to list to get that role.
The 60th anniversary season of San Diego Opera begins this fall with friend of the show Keturah Stakhan directing La Boheme as conducted by a friend of the show Lydia Yankovskaya. In the spring, two productions conducted by Eva Bell begin with Zalome, starring Marcy Stonikos in the title role. Then, Andreana Chuchman sings La Traviata with bass baritone Hunter Enoch and tenor Zach Borachevsky, husband of a friend of the show, so a friend-in-law of the show.
In an interview for Le Monde, Gustavo Dudamel revealed the reasons which led him to leave the Paris Opera last year. The Venezuelan conductor wants to make it clear that his decision was not a simple impulse. In addition to improving his personal life, he cited the cancellation of a major international tour of the Paris Opera Orchestra and the numerous non-musical obligations to which he was subject, creating a workload greater than he envisaged.
A concert in Switzerland to be performed by Anna Netrebko and Yusuf Avazov has been canceled. The Lucerne Culture and Congress Center made the decision to de-platform the singers given the, quote, temporal and geographical proximity of Ms. Netrebko's performance to the Ukraine Peace Conference and concerns over potential protests of the, quote, controversial artist. Management for Netrebko argues that she condemned the war in Ukraine back in 2022 and that the peace conference is set for 2 weeks after the scheduled Lucerne concert. Meanwhile, Netrebko's performances of Turandot and Wiesbaden are sold out, despite a peaceful protest of around 400 people outside the theater.
On May 3rd, audiences at Wiener Staatsoper welcomed Xavier Anduaga to encore the aria Una Furtiva Lagrima during a performance of The Elixir of Love. The 28-year-old Spanish tenor shared a video of the encore on Instagram, saying, "Sinceramente,
I honestly have no words to describe how I felt last night. Probably one of the most special nights of my career."
That George Cedarbot is really coming along. Crunching the numbers, Vancouver Opera has broken its 64-year all-time record in ticket sales with their recent production of Carmen. Quote, "We're thrilled to see Carmen resonate so deeply with audiences, setting a new standard for success for our company," so said General Director Tom Wright. Two shows were completely sold out, with extremely limited seating for the remaining performances.
In trade news, the Opera Orchestra of Montpellier has announced that American conductor Roderick Cox will become the youngest music director in the company's history. He'll begin his tenure for the 24-25 season. Meanwhile, the Guildhall School of Music in London has appointed soprano Sarah Tynan as the new head of vocal arts, and Knives Out director Ryan Johnson is the newest board member at LA Opera.
On the disabled list, Jonas Kaufmann canceled his The Sound of the Movies concert on May 7th, posting, "Unfortunately, laryngitis has forced me to cancel tomorrow's concert in Munich. Canceling is always a very last resort, but in this case, I am not well enough to perform. Tickets will be refunded. I appreciate your understanding and support and look forward to performing for you again very soon." The German tenor is set to sing a concert in Sofia next week, and to round out this very royal episode, a concert on May 16th to celebrate Antonio Pappano's retirement from the Royal Ballet and Opera.
And on this day, May 6th in 1637, it was the opening of the Teatro San Cassiano in Venice. First performances include Campra and Desmarais' Amphigenie en Tauride in Paris in 1704, Giovanni Bononcini's Astianate in 1727 in London, Niccolò Giomelli's Luce Latrice in Venice in 1751, Antonio Sacchini's Tamerlano in London in 1773, Etienne Méhul's Mélidor et Froissine in Paris in 1794, André Gretry's Le Barbier du Village in Paris in 1797, Ambroise Thomas' Le Panier Fleuri in Paris in 1839, Michael Haydn's Die Hochzeit auf der Alm, a Singspiel in Salzburg, premiering posthumously in 1868. Hans Werner Henze's Das Wundertheater in Heidelberg in 1949. Dominic Argento's The Boor in Rochester, New York in 1957. Leoncavallo's La Boheme in Venice, Out of Order in 1897. And in 1928, a first performance of Ernst Krenek's opera triptych, Der Diktator, Das Geheime Königreich, Schwergewicht oder Die Erde der Nation. Three bangers in one triptych. Birthdays include 1714, German tenor Anton Roth, who created title roles in Mozart's Idomeneo, Niccolo Piccini's Catone in Utica, J.C. Bach's Themistocle and Lucio Silla, and Ignaz Holzbauer's Gunther von Schwarzburg. In 1881, Bulgarian composer Georgi Atanasov. In 1882, Italian soprano Ina Maria Ferraris, who created the role of Lisette in La Rondine. Happy birthday to American baritone Richard Stilwell, born in St. Louis on this day in 1942. And happy birthday to contralto and conductor Natalie Stutzmann, born May 6, 1965.
That is your two-minute drill.
Couldn't resist listening to a little bit of Die Mainacht, since this is our first show in May, sung by Natalie Stutzmann with her regular collaborator, pianist Inger Södergren, on their exquisite Brahms recording on RCA. Get it if you don't have it.
I was going to suggest that we listen to something from that Ernst Krenek triptych.
One from each.
This is a true story. I used to have a recording of all three. I've only heard Der Diktator once because it was stolen from my dorm room at some point in my junior year. I don't know who has it or why they stole it. Why that was the one of the three they went for, but it was missing. I checked everywhere. I looked when I packed up the room. It is gone. So if you are listening and you stole my Der Diktator CD, I'm still salty about it.
Dang,
so
man.
Funny. My car used to get broken into all the time. I had all these opera CDs in the car seat next to me, like in the passenger seat. They took everything else. They even took the stereo, but they left the opera CDs.
Probably wasn't the same thief as mine then.
Yeah. That's okay. Crazy. So the headline for me about Royal Opera House is that the season opens with Figaro, starring Ying Fang as Susanna and Hugh Montague Rendell as the Count. I cannot believe it. I love that idea of those two singers on the same stage together. Ginger Costa Jackson, I assume, will be singing the Contessa. And Luca Micheletti will be singing Figaro. That's in September. Find me there.
I'm really excited for a couple of shows. They're doing Yenufa with Corinne Winters.
That's the same show we saw.
A lot of more standard rep. I do want to point out again the Die Walküre with Lisa Davidson. That's going to be a Barry Kosky production, and I think he really thrives in sort of that Wagner sort of Reggie Theater light world, so I'm hoping he leans into that a little bit. I think the other highlight, which we didn't mention in the actual drill itself, is the conclusion of the season, which is going to be Handel Semele. Semele. No, it's not Semele. It's German.
Semele. Semele.
It's okay. George has never heard of that one. That's Dude. With Pretty Yende, Ben Bliss, and Alice Coote, who's going to be great in that. I really like Semele a lot. I think that a lot of Handel's operas tend to kind of fall through the cracks. But luckily, with the Royal Opera House, you do have more of an incentive to do more Handel. So I think this is something that they're going to knock out of the park.
Tales of Hoffmann, with Juan Diego Flores, which is a big role for him, a lot more romantic and heroic demands on the voice than I'm used to hearing him sing. But a pretty cool cast, Emmanuel Eliajo, Marina Costa Jackson.
Tales of Hoffman, more like Tales of Huffman. Ted Huffman is directing the new production of Eugene Onegin, Tchaikovsky's opera. So Ted Huffman, he is an American director who has kind of jumped ship to Europe and has had great success there. Originally, he's from Connecticut. I'm excited for this production to see what he does. The last time he was at Royal Opera House was in 2016, directing, I believe, in the Studio Theater, the Philip Venables opera, based on the play by the playwright whose name escapes me. It's called Sarah Kane, 448 Psychosis, which is a dark, that's a dark show. So excited for Ted. The other show that is very dark is this production of Festin. So this was originally a film, then turned into a play, and then now it's an opera, the libretto by Lee Hall, who I think wrote Billy Elliot, and directed by the famous Richard Jones, one of the best British directors out there. This is also a really dark play. There is accounts of like sexual abuse of children in it. I'm not sure how this is going to go over. I have my doubts about this one. I also have my doubts about the Bernstein double bill.
Oh, it's the first time they're doing that over there.
Something freaks me out when non-American directors direct Bernstein.
That's fair. There's a certain, I don't know, reduction that
it is. There's a reductionism to it, right? And I'm not saying they can't. I'm not going to go down that path of saying who can and cannot make art, because that's no fun. People who are not American looking at American culture and looking at archetypes of American culture and not actually really going deep enough. This happened with Simon Stone directing the like trailer park trash version of Lucia, I think it was a couple years ago at the Met. And I went off on that guy and I was very unhappy about that. Ollie Mears, the head of opera at Royal Opera House, great guy. Would love to have him on the show sometime. Just curious about how this Bernstein double bill is going to go over and how realistic this is going to be, if it's going to be about American culture.
You're just salty because they didn't ask you. Some quick hits on Friends of the Show. Who is singing in London? Kate Lindsay and Hansel and Gretel. Rachel Willis-Sorensen in Il Trovatore. Charles Castronovo in Carmen. Freddie de Tomas, he's not a friend of the show, but Freddie de Tomas was a friend of my other show in Carmen. Christian Van Horn in Carmen. We already talked about Lisa Davidson in Die Walküre. Lisette Oropeza singing Marguerite in Faust. That's it. The rest you can kick rocks.
Well, I was just going to say, as far as renaming the opera house goes, like, you know, what's in a name? I mean, is this what's going to happen to the Lyric? Is that the Joffrey, which also, you know, rents the Lyric in the winter months? No. Are we going to see that turned over? I guess what's the point? Is the branding of it, and we're trying to... Well,
I do think that there is something nice about acknowledging the ballet company, because they're important too.
Nice?
You know?
That was so belittling, dude.
They're so nice. I think it is nice. It's
so
a good,
nice.
I think it's a good thing. This is something that has happened for a long time where, you know, when... They operate as sort of independently of each other, but they're using the same space to the point where they will occasionally have fights over scheduling. If, like, you know, a ballet production is right on top of an opera production, they get into a huge tiff over who gets the rehearsal space, you know. And I think that it's good to it's sort of along the same lines that we're seeing an increasing sort of respect for seeing librettists' names in operas now.
Okay.
You know,
I get it. Yeah.
And you know, the reason it's the Royal Opera House Ballet is because they do appear in a lot of productions. Not every production, but True. They do appear, and they are a part of it, and they do their own independent stuff there. I wouldn't want it to supplant the opera house entirely, because you know, I think first and foremost they are. Or should be an opera company, but mm-hmm. the ballet is an essential part of it, and it is independent enough so that I think that those dancers deserve some respect. It, what they do is hard and amazing, and you know, even though I spend all my money going to operas instead of the ballet, I really should go to more ballets.
Look, dancing in a ballet is like playing one snap in the NFL. Your body is never the same again.
Absolutely.
And it's a punishing art form. The Handel biopic. Okay, so who is actually going to see this?
Me?
Besides Oliver.
if it's done right,
yeah.
What's so great about these biopics, as was the case with Amadeus, is that you introduce a whole new audience to this music. And there's so much cool music from Handel that it's already so cinematic. And you know, just thinking of his like slow laments, you know, like A mio cor from Alcina, you know, whenever people hear that, it just sounds so dramatic. It's just like a heart beating really slow, you know, and like just people are just completely dazzled by the spell that aria casts, you know.
So this is gonna be Anthony Hopkins in a wig being like, "We shall feed his flock like a shepherd, Clarice." with all the biopics, you know, in the last couple of years in classical music, it sort of begs the question, like, who else merits a biopic from Operaland?
Well, if I could choose one, you know, biopic topic, it would definitely be Britten. And
yes,
Pairs.
Agree.
That'd be a good one.
There's also, once again, so much cool music to frame it. Sort of like the isolation and, you know, when you go in exile, Peter Grimes, and, you know, kind of mirrors the exile of Britten to the US. And of course, if you want to make, you know, gay, sexy time on stage. the music from Midsummer Night's Dream, some of it is so erotic.
Mm, mm.
Love it.
Who would play Britten in Pairs?
I feel like Timothy Chalamet as Britten.
Dude, that is so predictable. Oh my God.
Wispy boy.
Let's ask our listeners to write to us, you know, use the website or email us. Who should play Benjamin Britten? Who should play Peter Pierce?
What Dune actor should play? It's not opera and it's not quite a biopic, but I really envision the story of Carlo Gesualdo told in the form of an A24 horror film.
So I'm imagining that, you know, Gustavo Dudamel, who used to be, you know, the Klaus Mechala of his time, you know, just like the young kid who's like getting all the jobs. That, you know, he found himself at this appointment and he realized he's like traveling all over the world, going back and forth from LA to Paris, and now envisioning having to go from New York to Paris, which is probably
brutal time change.
Yeah. Yeah. And like he probably was like, I don't want to do all this fundraising. It's like, that's not what I signed up for,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, he says that there was a tour that got canceled and maybe he's doing an Esa Pekka Salonen, you know, before it was cool to quit your job like Esa Pekka Salonen did.
He's quiet quitting. Let's wrap this show up.
Good call, bad call on Opera Box Score.
Good call, bad call to wrap things up on the show this week, starting with Oliver Camacho.
Two quick good calls. Go see Challengers. And if you're trying to figure out what music you heard in the Challengers that you love, besides the amazing soundtrack, they used arrangements of Purcell's Sound the Trumpet and Purcell's Ode, Come Ye Sons of Art. I was able to name that instantly upon hearing the first few bars, but I needed a second to remember what it was for my good call. The other good call, and I'm very, very late to the game, is Alexander Ekman's Midsummer Night's Dream, which just closed at the Joffrey Ballet here in Chicago. It was the second production in Chicago of the show. If it comes to a ballet company near you, check it out. It's stunning. It's chaos. It's totally erotic. It's a little bit scary too. It feels a little bit like the movie Midsommar. Mm-hmm.
See, that's the A24 horror film I was talking about.
Yeah, there is something a little bit horrifying about it, but it's just imagery that will stick with you. I thought it was so powerful and not profoundly powerful. Just like while you're watching it, you're very like engaged with it. You leave the theater and you're like, okay, that was really cool. But while you're watching, it's like, this is like awesome. Wow. I could watch this every day.
Awesome. So. I got a bad call. I saw some lousy improv in Chicago this week. It happens, you know. That's it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show about opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get your voice heard. Find links to stuff we've talked about at the website, operaboxscore.com. That's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. Give back to the OBS and donate using the Support the Team tab. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant is Oliver Camacho. And your audio editor is Weston Williams. For our guest, Lawrence Edelson, I'm George Cedarquist, asking you to continue the conversation about opera. Excuse me, ballet and opera. Mm-hmm. We're back with an all-new show next week. Plus, you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more temporal and geographical distance from controversial artists. Join us.